Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, the United States Army Corps of Engineers wants you to, well, it wants Congress, really, your representatives, you, in the sense of the people who represent you, to act decisively and set up a commission. That's what I mean by decisive. To oversee the 100,000 miles of U.S. levees. The purpose? To prevent the next catastrophic flood. That's right. A commission will do it. How about a commission to investigate what happened in New Orleans? We don't need one of those. About $1.2 billion should be spent over the next 5 years to set up the commission and fix the aging and inadequate levee systems. This is a report by the National Committee on Levee Safety. Oh, actually, this is a report from Congress. But it was overseen by the Army Corps of Engineers. Good overseeing, boys. As a nation, our call to action is not predicated on if the next levee system fails and causes catastrophic damage, but when and where it fails. To improve the levees, Congress should set up a commission similar to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the FERC. They did so well during the Enron spectacle. The report said levees are in such bad shape that a wide range of steps needs to be taken to make them safer and to change public attitudes about the threat posed by living near rivers and water. The report didn't assess any particular levee systems. People in New Orleans know what they got. The complacency, they say, is rooted in Congress's flood insurance program, which had the unintended consequence of encouraging communities to build just enough flood protection to offset the risk of a 100-year flood, which means someone has a 26% chance of having their house flooded over the span of a 30-year mortgage, as John Barry explained in this program some time ago. Those are actually pretty high levels of risk. All right, the Army Corps of Engineers oversaw that call for fixing the levees built by the Army Corps of Engineers. It's one small step for man. Oh, and ladies and gentlemen, the good people at FEMA are hard at work blaming the citizens of Louisiana for being too gluttonous. Nearly 5 months after Hurricane Gustav, there's a public relations battle between Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana and FEMA over who was to blame for the exasperating depletion of emergency food and water supplies soon after Hurricane Gustav, which mainly hit southwest Louisiana. This is not about New Orleans. FEMA's argument, contained in a retort to comments made by Jindal last week, is that basically the responsibility for the problem lies with the storm victims of Louisiana, who gobbled up food and water at a, quote, extraordinary, unquote, rate after Gustav swept through southwest Louisiana. FEMA said it worked closely with state officials to pre-position what was believed to be an adequate supply of meals, ready-to-eat packets, water bottles, ice, and tarps, but the actual demand was far greater, and resupply efforts stumbled. The governor, his spokeswoman said, the governor made it clear that it is nutty to tell the people of South Louisiana that we are simply eating too much and are choosing MREs over our terrific local cuisines. The controversy started when Jindal, on at least two occasions in the past week, brought up the post-Gustav supply problem. Don't criticize FEMA. You'll be sorry you did. And before very much other time passes.
High def, low def, no def, take my hand. It's a digital wonderland. Got to be so careful where you stand in the digital wonderland.
Okay, from listener Ron, it's wrong to blame the government for your correspondent last week's inability to buy both his converter boxes at the same time at Circuit City. I walked into my Best Buy with my coupons, grabbed two boxes off a large stack. The checkout girl charged me $19 each net. The Circuit City people were selling a load of hooey. Guess which chain is surviving? Ed writes, Dear Harry, I enjoyed your DTV discussion and have had a varied experience. I got coupons, bought converter boxes, hooked them up, and got worse reception than on analog. I bought an amplified antenna for about $50 at a big box store. Little improvement, a waste of money to the big box and the Chinese manufacturers that made it. I concluded that the DTV conversion is a ploy to get people to subscribe to cable because over-the-air reception is unacceptable. Then a friend recommended the coat hanger antenna described on YouTube. I built one with found materials, cost 20 minutes of time. Reception is better than analog. So I recommend that folks save their money on the promoted special antennas and instead Google coat hanger DTV antenna, Ed in New Jersey. And finally, Democrats in the House of Representatives proposed $650 million. I know, it used to sound like a lot of money, to continue that coupon program for the transition to digital television. Government, of course, had said it had run out of the $40 discount coupons for consumers to help pay for their boxes. $650 million should do the trick, don't you think? To get us into the digital wonderland. Hello, welcome to the show.
It's getting better all the time. I used to get mad at my school.
I can't complain.
The teachers that taught me weren't cool.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now,
he's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an inspector general. Oh, yeah.
You know what? The news of the inspectors general will be here moments from now. So just remember you heard that. I'm not going to play it again. But first, since things are getting better, they can't get no worse, let's check up at this terminal moment of the Bush administration on the status of the global war on terror, won't we? The Army is building $1.1 billion worth of military bases and other facilities in Afghanistan and is planning to start an additional $1.3 billion in projects this year, according to the Army Corps of Engineers. Good luck with those. Make sure you don't live downstream from them. That's almost $3 billion. That used to sound like a lot of money. Massive construction of barracks, training areas, headquarters, warehouses, and airfields for use by U.S. and Afghan security forces could reach $4 billion. That signals a long-term U.S. military commitment, doesn't it? Because it worked so well for the British and the Soviets there, didn't it? Meanwhile, elsewhere in the global war on terror, a former military prosecutor said in a declaration filed in federal court this week that the system of handling evidence against detainees at Guantanamo Bay is so chaotic, it is impossible to prepare a fair and successful prosecution. Daryl Vandeveld, a former lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserve, filed the declaration in support of a petition seeking the release of Mohammed Jawad, an Afghan who's been held at Gitmo just for 6 years. Just 6 years. Jawad was a juvenile when he was detained in Kabul after a grenade attack that wounded two Special Forces soldiers and their interpreter. Vandeveld, who served in Iraq and Afghanistan, was the lead prosecutor against Jawad until he asked to be relieved of his duties last year, citing a crisis of conscience. He said the case has been riddled with problems, including alleged physical and psychological abuse of Jawad by Afghan police and the U.S. military, as well as reliance on evidence that was later found to be missing, false, or unreliable. I choose unreliable, me personally. You know, just playing the odds. I discovered most physical evidence that had been collected had either disappeared or had been stored in unknown locations, he said. Evidence was scattered throughout databases and desk drawers and vaguely labeled containers are simply piled on the tops of desks of departed prosecutors. Because, you know, it's a system of justice. Meantime, a federal judge ordered the release this week of a detainee at Gitmo, ruling the government's evidence is too weak to justify the man's continued confinement. There's a trend going on here. It's the second time the U.S. District Judge Richard Leon has ordered the release of a detainee after examining government evidence, most of it classified. Leon said the Justice Department failed to prove that Mohammed Gharani, 21 now, was 14, I think, when they caught him, is an enemy combatant because it relied heavily on statements made by two other detainees whose credibility is questionable. A mosaic of tiles this murky reveals nothing about this petitioner with sufficient clarity to justify his detention. Gharani was picked up in Pakistan and turned over to the United States in 2002. One of the worst of the worst. He was 14. Oh, I know. They can be bad at 14. I wasn't bad at 14, but I know people who were. The government alleged Gharani traveled to Afghanistan and trained at an Al-Qaeda-affiliated military camp, fought at Tora Bora, and was a courier for high-level Al-Qaeda members. That's almost as bad as being a driver. Judge Leon said the government describes the credibility of one informant as undetermined. I'd call him curveball if I were them. But more. Yeah, we're wrapping up the global war on terror, just in case it doesn't continue. The top Bush administration official in charge of deciding whether to bring Guantanamo detainees to trial concludes that the U.S. military tortured, her word, a Saudi national who allegedly planned to participate in the 9/11 attacks. That's a real terrorist now. Interrogating with techniques that included sustained isolation, sleep deprivation, nudity, and prolonged exposure to cold, leaving him in a life-threatening condition. We tortured Mohammed al-Qahtani, says Susan Crawford in her first interview since being named convening authority of military commissions at Gitmo by Secretary Gates. His treatment met the legal definition of torture, and that's why I did not refer the case for prosecution. This is a real terrorist who won't be prosecuted because we tortured him. Crawford, a retired judge who served as general counsel for the Army during the Reagan administration and Pentagon Inspector General when Dick Cheney was Secretary of Defense, is the first senior Bush administration official responsible for reviewing practices at Gitmo to publicly state that a detainee was tortured. She said the combination of the interrogation techniques, their duration, and the impact on Qahtani's health led to her conclusion. It was that medical impact that pushed me over the edge to call it torture, she said. She's the head of the military commissions at Guantanamo. This is a worst of the worst guy. There's no doubt in my mind he would have been on one of those planes had he gained access to the United States in August 2001, she said of Qahtani. He's a muscle hijacker. He's a very dangerous man. What do you do with him now if you don't charge him and try him? Good question. Good idea to torture him. The global war on terror moves to Afghanistan, of course. As pointed out earlier, the planned U.S. military and counterinsurgency drive in Afghanistan is meeting public and official resistance that could delay and possibly undermine that costly belated effort that American officials now envision. This according to the Washington Post. The officials acknowledge they face an array of obstacles, including widespread Afghan public hostility to international forces. Well, that's never happened before. That shouldn't bother us. Sweep that aside. What else? The growing influence of Taliban insurgents in areas where central authority and services are scarce? Well, yeah, that happened before, right before the Taliban took over. And controversy over plans to establish village defense groups. Officials are also worried about the upcoming Afghan presidential election and the revived hostility between Pakistan and India next door. Meanwhile, the idea of a war on terror is a mistake. That's according just to the Foreign Secretary of Great Britain, because it puts too much emphasis on military force, writing in The Guardian. Hey, that's a great newspaper. I happen to know. Foreign Secretary Miliband said the idea had unified terrorist groups against the West. He said the right response to the threat was to champion law and human rights, not subordinate it. Never too late, babe. What year is it? Miliband repeated the views in a speech in Mumbai, India. The foreign secretary wrote that since 9/11, the phrase war on terror had defined the terrain when it came to tackling terrorism, and although it had merit, ultimately the notion is misleading and mistaken. So it has that kind of merit, that misleading and mistaken merit. Miliband continued, the phrase was all-encompassing and gave the impression of a unified transnational enemy embodied in the figure of Osama bin Laden when the situation was far more complex. Yeah, well, we didn't do complexity, babe. That's for the Brits. You get all the complexity. Calling for groups to be treated as separate entities with differing motivations and agendas, he wrote, it was not a simple binary struggle between moderates and extremists or good and evil, and treating them as such was a mistake. Historians will judge whether the notion of the global war on terror has done more harm than good. Well, if he doesn't believe in good and evil, he's evil. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I've brought you up to date on the global war on terror such as it is now, news of Inspectors General, like that it was sung about earlier. A $722 million project to restore Iraq's oil production facilities. What do you think? Worked perfectly, on time, on budget. Everything's up and running. It was undermined by weak management, contractor mistakes, and Iraqi neglect, says the report from the Special Inspector General for Iraqi Reconstruction. It points to security concerns, post-war looting. Hey, stuff happens. And the shoddy shape of the oil network as primary contributors to the cost of the contract awarded to Kellogg Brown and Root, formerly a subsidiary of Halliburton. As this weren't enough of a challenging climate, the effort administered by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was hampered by a lack of direction from the Corps? Seriously? Really? Should I get off the falsetto? Cost overruns and frequent contract changes led to work being delayed or canceled. The Inspector General's report says there were signs the Iraqis are not properly maintaining the rebuilt oil facilities and equipment. Gas plants in southern Iraq were renewed by KBR. A final step in the process was for the Iraqis to install rotors for a gas compressor that hasn't been done. As a result, gas production is below goal, and a portion of the U.S. investment is being wasted, says the Inspector General. The effort became so complicated that a separate company was paid $8.4 million to help KBR run the program. The government notified KBR of concern over the use of substandard piping material and fraudulent material certification. The Corps of Engineers generally agreed with the findings, but said the report doesn't emphasize enough the dangerous environment in which the work was being done. Aren't they part of the Army? A lawyer for the United States Marshals Service improperly used federal vehicles and on-duty deputies to escort him to World Series games, the Super Bowl, and other major sporting events where he freelanced and moonlight moonlighted as a part-time statistician for Fox Sports. That's according to a report made public this week by the Inspector General of the Justice Department. The lawyer, Joe Band, also arranged for deputy marshals to provide vehicle escorts for Fox Sports announcers at two World Series games in 2007 and an NFL playoff game in the Super Bowl in 2008. The broadcasters are identified as Tim McCarver, Joe Buck, and Troy Aikman. The, of course, irony is that Band has a job at the Marshals Service at the Office of General Counsel, and his job is advising employees on matters of ethics and integrity. But the report found that he repeatedly committed ethical violations. Well, he should know. You want the guy who knows how to violate the ethics rules, go to the ethics advisor. Fox hasn't paid the Marshal Service back, have they? Call the IRS. The U.S. food supply is at the risk of being invaded by unapproved imports of genetically modified crops and livestock, according to the Inspector General of the Agriculture Department. The report said the U.S. Department of Agriculture does not have an import control policy to regulate imported genetically modified animals, or actresses for that matter. The Inspector General's office recommended the department develop an overall control policy for all genetically modified imports and develop and implement a strategy to monitor crop and livestock development in other nations. Never too late. Department continues. More from the Inspector General. The Office of the Defense Department's Inspector General said it had found no wrongdoing in a Pentagon public relations program that made use of retired military officers working as military analysts for television and radio networks. This was prompted by articles in the New York Times that described a Pentagon effort to transform a group of high-profile network military analysts into, quote, surrogates or message force multipliers. The report dismissed as merely a personal view an email message written by a senior public affairs official at the Pentagon that urged her superiors to cultivate that group of military analysts, quote, that we can count on to carry our water. The report also said it couldn't find that the Pentagon had violated the law against government agencies propagandizing the citizenry because of the vagueness of the definition of propaganda. And finally, it's almost as vague as the Geneva Convention prohibition against outrages upon human dignity that so bewildered still President Bush. And finally, in the news of the Inspector General, a former Justice Department official entrusted with enforcing civil rights laws refused to hire lawyers whom he labeled as commies and transferred another attorney for allegedly writing in, quote, Ebonics and benefiting from, quote, an affirmative action thing. That's according to the Justice Department's, say it with me now, Inspector General. The department's Inspector General concluded that Bradley J. Schlossman violated civil service laws and made false statements about his activities in Congress when he denied politicizing appointments. Federal prosecutors declined to pursue a criminal perjury case against him. I guess that was good perjury, not criminal perjury. Over 3 years in which he controlled employment decisions at the Civil Rights Division, Schlossman favored young conservatives for entry-level jobs, transferred those he called right-thinking Americans into top assignments, and instructed colleagues that, quote, adherents of Mao's little red book need not apply, according to emails cited in the report. Authorities, these were all career positions, not political positions, that he was filling. Of the 112, analysts determined that nearly all of the lawyers whose political affiliations were known at the time had ties to Republican or conservative legal groups. The report's descriptions of racial and political bias at the Justice Department underscores the difficulty of the task before the new guys. The report marks the last in a series of investigations into the infusion of politics at the Justice Department. But getting back to Bradley Schlossman, these emails are pretty fine. In addition to calling his colleagues, his political colleagues, right-thinking Americans, and calling the existing career officials at the Civil Rights Division pinkos and crazy libs, Schlossman also said, I just want to make sure we don't start confining ourselves to, you know, Politburo members because they happen to be a member of some, you know, psychopathic left-wing organization designed to overthrow the government. Unquote, Brad Schlossman. He also called some of the attorneys in the Civil Rights Division, quote, mold spores, unquote. And he said, when he got more of his people in, now it's all good cop for folks there. I much preferred the role of bad cop. Maybe Brad Schlossman wasn't exercising a political policy. Maybe he was just establishing a brand. A brand called Schloss.
Civil rights, no fan of Al Gore's, who called his own attorneys mold spores.
Accuse the applause.
Who's the justice lawyer who emails from Kinko's that what he enjoys most is bitch slapping pinkos?
Schloss.
He believes in the cause. Who's the bureaucrat on top who seeks out libs and lays on them some bad cops?
Schloss.
You see, this Bradley Schlossman's a real rights thick enough.
Keep it down.
I'm talking about Schloss.
Okay, anything for Schloss.
He's an uncomplicated man, and the only ones who understand him are in the Federalist Society.
Brad
Schloss.
Southern California.
don't want to sleep. You might miss something. Whoa, 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 it's magical. I'm glad it happened to me. Knotted up in the van room, woke up in history. Surfer silhouettes, the sun went into the sea. As we headed home, we drove into a movie. Love songs, pretty girls, didn't want it to end. Tried to slow down the motion so it could move us again. In Southern California, dreams wake up for you. And when you wake up here, you wake up everywhere. Southern California. So it's magical.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Le Show, and some interesting news about the world of nuclear waste. Because it's clean, cheap, safe, too safe to meter, too cheap to be clean, something like that. One of those things. Dateline Germany. The heat has been turned up on Germany's Radiation Protection Office after it was revealed that an old salt mine in the German state of Lower Saxony has sustained damage. The reason it's interesting is because the old salt mine was a storage facility for nuclear waste, much like Yucca Valley, except there's actual nuclear waste in the salt mine in Lower Saxony. The Federal Office for Radiation Protection, the FORP, of course, it's not called that in German, fortunately, that would be the Dutch name for it, had learned late last year that pieces of the ceiling of the 2,500-foot-deep chamber, nothing's ever going to happen to that, that's going to be good for 10,000 years, were unstable and could collapse on top of the 6,000 radioactive waste drums beneath. The nuclear waste site is at a location called, and I'm not making this up, ASSE, ASSE. The information was posted discreetly on the Radiation Office's website late this week. Lower Saxony Environment Minister Hans-Heinrich Sander said he was only informed of the damage to the storage site this week, but the Radiation Office said the ministry had been informed all along. The ministry said it could not rule out damage to the waste containers should the ceiling collapse, but gave its reassurances that it would reinforce the seals of the chamber with concrete to stop any radioactive dust or air escaping. It's only a precaution. There's no immediate danger. The chamber contains only weak levels of radioactivity, unlike what's going to be stored at Yucca Valley for millions and millions and millions, no, thousands of years. But, you know, men are good at doing stuff that lasts thousands of years. Why, just look at, now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you? And I think you will.
Soft listen.
Slight changes in climate may trigger major abrupt ecosystem responses that are not easily reversible. Some of these responses, including insect outbreaks, wildfire, and forest dieback, may adversely affect people as well as ecosystems. The U.S. Geological Survey led a... Hey, that's in our government. They're not supposed to be doing that. Led a new assessment of the implications of a warming world on ecological thresholds in North America. This was authored by a team of federal and academic climate scientists, was a synthesis of published scientific literature, and it addresses what research and concrete steps are always better than wooden steps, don't you think, are needed to help mitigate resulting effects. An ecological threshold is the point at which there is an abrupt change in an ecosystem that produces large, persistent, and potentially irreversible changes. One of our biggest concerns is that once an ecological threshold is crossed, the ecosystem in question will most likely not return to its previous state, says Associate Director for Biology Susan Heseltine. We got to get Brad Schlaz on her ass. The existence of thresholds should be a key concern of scientists and natural resource managers. New research indicates that the ocean could rise in the next 100 years to a meter higher than the current sea level. I'm glad I don't know how big that is. Three times higher than predictions from the UN's panel on climate change. Groundbreaking new results from an international collaboration between researchers from the Niels Bohr Institute in Copenhagen, as well as researchers in England and Finland, are published in the journal Climate Dynamics. Canada's 1.2 million square miles of trees have been dubbed the lungs of the planet by ecologists because they account for more than 7% of the Earth's total forest lands. They could always be depended upon to suck in vast quantities of carbon dioxide. But no. In an alarming yet little-noticed series of recent studies, this from recent studies, scientists have concluded that Canada's precious forests, stressed from damage caused by global warming, insect infestation, and persistent fires, have crossed an ominous line, some would call it a threshold, and are now pumping out more carbon dioxide than they are sequestering. Worse yet, the experts predict that Canada's forests will remain net carbon sources, not sinks, until at least 2022 and possibly much longer. We're seeing a significant distortion of the natural trend, says Werner Kurtz of the Canadian Forest Service, the leading expert on carbon cycles in Canada's forests. Since 1999, and especially in the last 5 years, the forests have shifted from being a carbon sink to a carbon source. Canada's federal government effectively wrote off the nation's forests last year as officials submitted their plans to abide by the Kyoto Protocol. Governments are normally permitted to count forest lands as credits or offsets when calculating their carbon emissions, but Canadian officials, aware of these studies, omitted the forest lands from their compliance calculations. So yes, it's true. Blame Canada. I've been waiting for the evidence, and here it is. Well, it's not really Canada's fault. They can't help themselves. And finally, ladies and gentlemen, an epidemic of the viral disease Nephropathia epidemica, just reading the name made me sneeze, has been linked to increases in the vole population caused by hotter summers, milder winters, and increased seed production by broadleaf trees in Europe. New research links outbreaks of this rodent-borne disease to the known effects of global warming. Blame the Canadians and the voles. Ladies and gentlemen, the award-winning News of the Warm, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And it is, of course, the final weekend for the Bush administration. Presuming they're going to leave. I know. Everybody who thinks so badly of them thinks that they're just going to go, oh, yeah, but the limit of the term is the part of the Constitution we agree with. But let's make that assumption along with everybody else and see what's happening underground.
Next, intimate tales of America's first underground vice president. The action-packed diary of the man who's just a heartbeat away from history.
Dick Cheney, confidential. Like the ocean, history has tides. A high tide of a freedom agenda, a robust approach to executive power, and a rational way of dealing with our energy problems will possibly be followed by a low tide of statist meddling in the economy and the mollycoddling of terrorists abroad. Possibly. Maybe even in this country. Oh, sure, the external signs of change were all around us this week. CBs carting up the plasma screens and Lynn's crockpots. Other personnel cleaning and semi-restoring various hard drives. And like my constituent chief, I was spending an unusual amount of time above ground, participating in the penultimate phase of the Bush Legacy Project. While I was putting up with the usual sad attempts at tough questions from the only people in Washington who like to hear themselves talk more than senators, TV news anchors, the president was getting plaques and decorative flags and words of praise from Condé Rice. That's fine. I'll get my plaques and other honors the same way I got everything else around here. By stealth. And I'm sure that the new people coming on board have big plans to change everything around here, from geopolitical strategy to whether the toilet rolls unspool from front or back. I wish them luck. There are those within my secure and disclosed personality who think it'll take them change agents 4 years just to locate all the little surprises we've left for them. Now, a man's diary knows that a man isn't terribly big on sentiment. But there were a few emotional moments Friday afternoon, the so-called last day of work for the administration I've been proud to be a little more than a part of. My friend and advisor, hell, my muscle, Dave Addington, stopped by to burn some papers in the secure and disclosed furnace. And on a very cold day in our nation's capital, the flame of some disappearing emails warmed his heart and my pacemaker. Friday, 2:17 p.m.
Well, I could go over to State and yell at Condé one more time. Tell her to stay the hell out of Israel's way. The president has made this decision. She's out of her lane.
Dave, you did that yesterday.
I know, Dick, but here's the thing. I may not be able to do it tomorrow.
Dave, I think we've handled Ms. Rice pretty thoroughly by now. I think it'll be a good few years before she even has the confidence to order in a restaurant again.
All right, point well taken. Or at least taken. Mm-hmm. But we still got 3 more days, 72 more hours to project American power unambiguously. We've still got the contingency plans to attack Iran's nukes.
Dave.
Everybody's distracted by the celebrities in town. It's like a Friday afternoon on steroids. Mm-hmm. By the time anybody notices what happened, the attack will have been bumped off the air by the inauguliner.
Dave, I'd like nothing more for our parting shot than to bop Mr. Ahmadinejad smartly on the nuclear noggin.
Well, it's consequence-free for us. All follow-on responsibilities flow to the change gang.
Well, sir, let's just examine that premise more closely for a moment or two. Hmm? What are you doing starting Wednesday? Think tank? Law firm? Teaching?
Well, sir, actually, John Bolton, Dick Pearl, and I, and a few other individuals are taking some seed money from Heritage Foundation, forming a new institution to develop position papers in support of an ever more muscular approach to executive branch affairs. We're hoping you might want to come on board when things settle down.
Well, it sounds like a great idea. Clearly, in a time when everyone and his brother is trying to turn the Republican Party into some sort of bipartisan amen chorus, we're going to need policy prescriptions from a more robust point of view, no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. But I don't think I'm going to be going nonprofit at this point. Lynn has acquired a taste for fine crockery, and now that we've given ours back to the Navy, I've got to haul these old bones out and earn a new set.
New set of bones?
New set of crockery. Mm. Several sets, to be precise.
Back to Halliburton?
Not exactly. A smaller, lower-profile firm in the energy equipment business. Something not necessarily domiciled domestically.
Ah.
Firm that may have interests in locations that, speaking frankly, uh-huh, are better off not being impinged on by the kind of campaign you're talking about.
Your new employer is selling stuff to Iran?
Dave, my friend, we've had our time. We've done our work. With your prodigious assistance, we've rewritten the Federal Register more thoroughly than they rewrote the Second Act of Dolly in Boston. We've put our people on the bench inside the bureaucracy and on the headsets at the NSA. Our work is done. And our work goes on.
How much stuff?
Let's put it this way. If the CBs hadn't packed up all the crap in this room, mm-hmm, you'd be throwing some of it by now.
My friend, we'll meet again. Perhaps in a year or two we'll share some intoxicating beverage. We'll laugh at the mistakes of our successors. We'll bask in the knowledge that if history ever knew everything we did, it'd be dizzier than a starlet in a car wash. Take the rest of the day off, Dave. See you here in the morning.
For the purpose of?
Last reading of intercepts before we go civilian. Last gulp of the good stuff. See you then. As I say, I'm not the sentimental type. But I think I might just have seen in Dave Addington's face the first glimmer of disappointment in me that he's ever displayed. I can live with that. I never turned on the furnace. End of partial diary for January 18th, 2009. Sincerely yours, Dick Cheney, Confidential.
Confidential.
Soon we'll connect the dots.
Tomorrow night in Los Angeles at the Largo in Hollywood, the final live performance of Songs of the Bushmen, Bye Bye Bushmen version with that song, heavily featured. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Videoly featured. Bernard Madoff's neighbors have heard from him on December 22nd. White envelopes, each marked with an individual apartment number on it in pencil, arrived in the foyers of his fellow co-op members. Madoff was apparently overcome by guilt about the general media scrum surrounding the lobby of the building. The letter, printed out on simple white paper, said, "Dear neighbors, please accept my profound apologies for the terrible inconvenience I have caused over the past weeks. Ruth and I appreciate the support. Best regards, Bernard Madoff." Dayline Gaza, Israel Defense Minister Ehud Barak apologized to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon this week after Israeli forces shelled the main UN aid compound in the city of Gaza. Up to 700 Palestinians were being sheltered there. The compound was hit twice by fire. Three staff members were injured. Ban, visiting Israel, said he had protested strongly to Barak, who apologized and told him it was a, quote, grave mistake, unquote. Bad play on words. "I conveyed my strong protest and outrage to the defense minister and the foreign minister and defended a full explanation." Ban said the defense minister said to me it was a grave mistake and he took it very seriously. He assured me extra attention will be paid to UN facilities. Of course, now a ceasefire has been called. The Czech EU presidency, EU being the European Union, has apologized for an art installation it commissioned that lampoons national stereotypes. Czech Deputy Prime Minister Alexandra Vondra apologized directly to Bulgaria, which has formally complained over its depiction in the artwork as a toilet. He said the image in Brussels would be removed if Bulgaria insisted. David Cherny, the Czech artist behind the work, admits misleading officials over his intentions with the project. He said he'd wanted to find out if Europe is able to laugh at itself. The Czech Republic thought it had commissioned work from 27 European artists for the display, but it turned out the work, an 8-ton mosaic, was entirely completed by Mr. Cherny and two associates. As well as portraying Bulgaria as a toilet, the exhibit depicts Romania as a Dracula theme park and France as a country on strike. Bulgaria is not a toilet? Dateline Keller, Texas, Superintendent James Weitenheimer apologized this week, saying that the school district's now abandoned plan not to show next week's presidential inauguration was wrong. Administrators had decided that teachers should stick to the curriculum scheduled for Tuesday instead of using school time to let students view the swearing-in. But some teachers, parents, and community members disagreed. On Wednesday, the district announced the classes could view the event as part of the social study curriculum. "It was not one of our better decisions," Weitenheimer said. "We worked quickly to correct it." The former chief of voting rights at the Justice Department has apologized. He sent a letter of apology to Mary Frances Berry, the one-time chairman of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. He had said Tanner had, John Tanner, that he liked his coffee Mary Frances Berry style, black and bitter. He says it was a very poor choice of words, flippant and ill-considered. The term bitter, of course, he further explained, meant no sugar in the coffee and was not meant as a reflection on you or your attitude towards the changing situation. Screen Actors Guild board member Francis Fisher has apologized for suggesting a boycott of 8 nominees at the upcoming Guild Awards who oppose the union executives' efforts to get a strike authorization. "I apologize directly to Josh Brolin, Kevin Spacey, Susan Sarandon, Michael C. Hall, Sally Field, Alec Baldwin, Steve Carell, and Tony Shahoub for any discomfort my actions may have caused." She had forwarded a pair of anonymous emails proposing that SAG members not vote for the 8 since they opposed the strike authorization. Dayline London, TV show judge Sharon Osbourne won a public apology and substantial libel damages this week after a newspaper had said she was driving her rock star husband, Ozzy, to destruction. Rupert Murdoch's Sun tabloid newspaper admitted that there was no truth to the allegations and has apologized. Yes, it's Rupert Murdoch versus Sharon Osbourne. Who can you root for? Whom? National public relations firm Ketchum has apologized today, actually this week, for an employee's online posting that appeared to trash FedEx's hometown. Ketchum and the offending employee, blogger and vice president James Andrews, issued statements apologizing for a posting that drew the ire of FedEx employees after he tweeted, "I'm in one of those towns where I scratch my head and say, I would die if I had to live here." FedEx and he have apologized. Which reminds me, I was watching a Detroit Pistons basketball game last night, and these talk about turns of phrase you want to pull back. The sportscaster said, "And Detroit will be in Memphis Monday, and what better place to be on Martin Luther King Day?" Take two. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, on neither satellite radio network, because they merged, and I guess, you know, mergers are good. Around the world via the internet, though, at two different locations, because the internet doesn't merge. Live and archived, you can locate this program at harryshear.com and kcrw.com. Available as a free download for members at www.audible.com/LeShow, and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'll be just like the healing starting, if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you? All righty, thank you very much. And also, I'll see you, if you choose to come, Monday night at the Largo in Hollywood for Bye Bye Bushman, 9 p.m. And as always, on the video side at mydamnchannel.com. A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks as always to Pam Halstead. The email address for this broadcast and the playlist for the songs heard here, just part of the ever-growing melange at harryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.